Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about wizards. Should you play one? Are they the best class? Why are they the best class? All this and more on this episode of Wandering DMs. So of course, Paul, we have had a number of episodes where we've been questing after the original core classes and kind of hash them out. And we've done clerics and thieves, which are maybe the more troubling ones. And we've done fighters 2 weeks ago. And now finally, we're going to complete the tetret with wizards today.
Excellent. So, I don't know. Maybe we should expand this down the road and go into some, you know, subclasses. And actually, we did an episode on subclasses, didn't we? Now that I say that out loud.
Did we? But not focus like specifically on wizards. Yeah.
No. Yeah. All right. So wizards or magic.
I will say this. I'm making notes this morning, and I know I was running late, which caused you some problems on your end. But this is the longest series of notes, I think, for any episode I've ever prepped for. So I fear that just wizards alone might possibly be a six episode miniseries.
All right. Excellent. All right, let's get into it. So, one of the original three core classes in OD&D, right? Yeah. OD&D, you had magic users, fighting man, and cleric, right?
Right.
And we've certainly discussed to death how cleric feels like an odd addition, possibly slightly out of fiction, because it was, you know, based on those, Harryhausen movies, I want to say, something like that?
Something like that. Remember anymore.
All right, so...
Or Bishop Odo from, like, is what a lot of people point to or whatever.
Interesting. So if you go back, if you take out clerics, I'm talking about clerics, then we're really just down to magic users and fighters. And magic users really are what bring the game into the fantasy world, right? Like, you start with chainmail, which is pure medieval combat. Mm-hmm. And then from there you get into... you know, what do you add to make it fantasy? Wizards and dragons, right?
Yeah.
And elves and dwarves and
I mean, keep in mind, you know, people say, like, they try to argue that D&D doesn't have a big connection to Tolkien, but the very first fantasy element is hobbits. That comes first in chainmail fantasy, right? And then more or less you go through a sequence of monsters, which is more or less just the order that they appear in Tolkien, actually. And so you get the hobbits and elves and dwarves, and then later on you get the wizards and dragons, and they're clearly the ones that capture people's imagination the most, certainly. So that's definitely your killer addition to a game is when you have that, certainly. And of course, there's a lot of historical precedents, right? So I was like leafing through John Peterson's Playing at the World, and he has a nice kind of overview of they are something that's like a very deep part of every culture's mythology is, you know, humans or something like humans who can wield magical powers is something that's very deeply embedded in our fantastic consciousness. And you have things like that in ancient mythology, and, you know, Prospero from Shakespeare's The Tempest basically looks exactly like a normal D&D magic user. He wears a robe and he carries a staff, right? And that looks like Gandalf and, that looks like wizards from Jack Vance's stories. And then, there's a lot of Doctor Strange from the comic books being published at the same time as D&D that comes in. So it's a very, you know, it's a very deep thing that kind of taps into a lot of stuff that we all kind of just naturally know from whatever culture we're coming from almost.
Awesome. So where should we start in terms of wizards and D&D?
All right. Let me start by pitching like why I personally like them. All right. So I'm going to argue that they're the best class. They make the most sense.
Yeah. They're certainly my go-to, right? That's if I'm making a new D&D character, wizard is usually the first thing I make.
Yep. Okay. And me too. And I come to the table and I want to fit in with the rest of the party as a player. And I say, what do we need? And I say, if no one else wants it, I'm happy to play the wizard. And among the things that I really like about it, as we've talked about several times, is the graduated complexity in the game, right? Mm-hmm. In the original game, fighters, totally mundane. You can just common sense it. Thieves or clerics or whatever, there's a couple more rules to involve. And then when you get to wizards, it unlocks this whole subset, this whole subsystem of the magical spell section that takes a much larger amount of time of study to understand and master and understand the options. Mm-hmm. And I really like expert players having this, being able to dial in their level of interest instead of having to mangle the whole system entirely to make expert players happy.
Let me pick at that a little bit because I know that, I'm reminded of the anecdote where it was Isabel who said, disinvited artist Isabel Carbani, who said that, had started off in fighters and then
let me just say, spanked me horribly in the war game last night. So in a Book of War war game, she spanked me horribly. So go check that out.
Wasn't it she that said, had been playing wizards or playing fighters originally when she first got into D&D and then eventually got into wizards, and you said to her something like, oh, you've graduated to the power class. But what about clerics, right? Clerics have spells. Why are clerics not as complex as wizards?
Well, interesting, like in original D&D, they do not have spells at first level is the first thing I'll stab at. So when you start, if you start a first level cleric, you do not have to deal with any spells in original D&D or BX, right? Still the case in BX?
Yep.
I think that's the case. Yeah. So obviously fewer in original D&D, there's only five levels of cleric spells. And I think the first level list only has like four or five spells on the whole list. And they're supposed to be supportive, right? They're supposed to be helpful and supportive. And I don't think that captures people's imaginations as much as fireballs or mentally enslaving monsters to your purposes or things like that. So I think that, I think there's that.
I mean, I think you're right, right? The spell list on clerics was always shorter, right? There was fewer spells on it. And a lot of those spells are these kind of support spells where they're tasks that are useful, that are helpful to the group, but you're probably not going to revamp in weird ways, right? I've never seen someone come up with a very clever use of Cure Light Wounds, right? It's Cure Light Wounds. What do you want? It gives you hit points back.
Right. And on that point, admittedly, I haven't had clerics in my game for so long that I'm almost, my memory's getting hazy, but I know there's a lot of people, I think, that have said that if they come to the table with a cleric and they haven't used every single slot just for Cure Light Wounds, all the other players get angry at them. So I think that there's also this, I'm obligated to come just with the Cure Light Wounds and nothing else because the hit points are such a key part of the game.
Right. I mean, that gets into, we're going to dive accidentally into a tirade about clerics. So I want to step away from that a little bit, just because you're right. Clerics, generally fewer spells to choose from and the spells that they are choosing from more in a support nature. And as our commenters point out, they have more equipment, right? So they're kind of like a middle ground between fighter and wizard, right? Magic user. Okay. Right. Magic user is really interesting, I think, especially in old school play. In old school play, my impression is I know a lot of my players actually don't like playing magic users because at the first level they're so limited, right? At first level you have barely any hit points, you have no armor to speak of, and you have one spell.
Right. And so there's really old pieces of analysis, and obviously I didn't come up with any of this, but number one, the fact that wizards are a glass cannons is that at least once they get to a higher level, they have the most powerful single shot attack abilities, but at the same time, they're still very fragile at almost any level that you're at. Yep. And two, I think there's also been the analysis of linear fighters, but quadratic wizards. Like the slope of power, it should be going in this direction. The slope of power for fighters is pretty much the same, add a hit die linearly, whereas the wizard's power is increasing quadratically or close to exponentially as you go up the levels, which is an interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah. But at first level, they're incredibly weak.
I'm always reminded of there's an old song, and I don't even know who to credit this to, but probably from back in the 80s or even 70s. There's an old D&D song called "Always the First to Die." Yes. And it's specifically about a player wrestling with that, about being forced to play the magic user because no one else wants him. And he's got to play the magic user, and he keeps dying, And he dies over and over again. And there's a line in there of, you may suck at level 1, but you're rip at level 9.
Yeah, interesting. And I will say that also emphasizes the fact that the original game was team-based, right? So, you know, maybe as time goes on, there's more of like, is your character like a highlight, get a highlight all on their own or not. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. in the early days, there was more of an emphasis. You had to accept that you were working as a team, and the books had a lot of text about how do you plan, cooperate, work as a team. And if you're playing a wizard, you better get some friggin' fighters around you to protect you. And that actually emphasizes what, again, Ernie Gygax told us in our interview with him last Sunday, that was really surprising to me, but actually solved a lot of problems, was exactly this. Oops. That you're pulling up on screen right now. The fact that, you know, we all know his father, Gary's famous characters, Mordenkainen and Bigby, and they have a whole lot of books under their name alone. But they were henchmen. They were not, those wizard characters were not Gary Gygax's main PCs. His main PC was a fighter named Irag, which is obviously Gary backwards, right? And the wizards were actually henchmen employed by him that ultimately got too big for their britches and became known for their own things. And, you know, that kind of resembles what's happening in my own original D&D games the last couple of months that we were playing, is that the players were routinely putting out calls for henchmen for wizards. That was happening all the time. And there was a really high body count to those wizard henchmen. And so the joke was there's a nearby college, and they're just sending large numbers of graduates to be these henchmen getting chewed up one after the other. Hopefully, at some point, one of the henchmen wizards gets to a high enough level that they actually have some powerful magic. But yeah,
it's interesting.
You know, so maybe
I usually, in my campaigns in the past, I'm usually pretty stingy about allowing wizards to be henchmen. Typically most of the henchmen I allow for are fighters and thieves, and that's it.
Makes sense.
And frankly, I've always sort of been of the opinion that wizards generally are going to do the hiring, right? That because there are lots of fighters and thieves willing to hire themselves out, a wizard isn't going to go hire himself out as a mercenary to another group. He's going to start his own group and hire a bunch of fighters and thieves to help him.
Makes sense. That's a strong argument. Super strong argument. Maybe I should do that.
Really reluctant to give magic users as henchmen.
I think I think that's a good point. I think I was at the table and they said I think my players were like, we're going to put out a call specifically for magic user henchmen, and I think there was a moment where my gut felt icky about that, weird. Honestly, but I didn't have at the very moment I didn't have a coherent theory about it, so I said yes by default, which is what I tend to do. So maybe I should rethink that, because that seems like a really solid argument on your part. Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. It's funny because I did it, I think, just instinctually at first, and I don't think I really spent a lot of time thinking about why should there not be magic user henchmen, but I don't know. It's the take I took, and I'm happy with it. It's interesting. Yeah. So does that mean that none of your players are playing magic users?
They tend to be elf multi-class, right? They tend to be, the other thing is they tend to be elven fighter magic users to kind of get the benefits of both sides. Mm-hmm. I have one single player who has a straight magic user, and they're a little underpowered, honestly. She's not totally happy with what the dynamic's been, to be perfectly frank. Around third, fourth level, you know, when we put that game on hiatus back in January, we were just getting to the point of some people were getting to fifth level and getting access to third level spells. So I think that some of the primary interest there at the mid levels was just getting started when we put it on pause. I'll say that, the other thing is that at the end, you know, the last couple of years, Gary Gygax was playing games, you know, he would start people at third level.
Right.
And so that makes everybody a little bit more robust. that gives the magic users in original D&D at least four spells, one of which is second level. And so even he was boosting people a little bit and starting at third level.
Yep. And I feel like you see the inverse in later editions of D&D, where instead we add cantrips, right?
Yeah.
We add lesser spells
right.
that can be cast. Right. Cantrips are really interesting, right? Because those have really changed in 5th edition.
Yes.
What I found from playing, because I played in a campaign, a 5th edition campaign, where I took a magic user, a wizard, a straight wizard from 1st level to about 10th.
Right.
And cantrips are really very different in 5th, I think, than they are in other editions of the game.
Yeah, I made a note here to talk about that, too. That is one of the hardest things as an old schooler for me to wrap my head around stepping. And I think they started that with 4th edition, I think, of A. So obviously cantrips came up in late 1st edition, whereby maybe you could get maybe 4, and absolutely none of them were useful in combat in any way whatsoever. Right.
Right. This and is Unearthed Arcana, right? Is where they first showed up, I want
correct.
To say.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly. And so it was like a way to give, as you're saying, like some extra spells, but they were actually just useless except for, you know, flavor purposes. And in fact, one of them was literally just called flavor, as it will salt your food for you, basically. That kind of thing. And then 3rd edition made some of the cantrips do damage for the first time. And then I think it was 4th edition that made cantrips be ever present, so you could just use it. There's the first time that D&D had a spell that you could just use over and over and over again with no limit. And so for me, when I step into 5th edition, that is really hard for me to wrap my head around, is an ever present spell you can use every round that does damage. That is super different than what I'm used to in the game.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's very odd. I think it's very odd. I have mixed feelings. Mixed feelings about 5th edition cantrips.
That's one of the hard, when I step into the game, that's the hardest thing for me to wrap my head around. So we should talk about the Vancian tradition. So I think that, you know, anybody that analyzes D&D knows that the magic spells are Vancian, which is to say that Gary borrowed the conceit from the stories of Jack Vance that spells are formula that experts can imprint into their brain, and then when they utter the magic syllables, the power is actually expunged from their brain for the rest of the day. And I like that, right? And we will forever have debates about whether people like that or not in classic versions of D&D. That's something they've gotten away from in newer versions, but I like it. For me, it makes sense. It's a simple mechanic. It's a binary. Either you have it or you don't. You cast the spell, you just cross it off your list. It works very well in the stories of Jack Vance. So I can see both it hits the two buttons of it's both good game design and simple, and also good flavor and thematics from Jack Vance. The other thing for me, right, that tickles me is the fact that in the original short story of Jack Vance, it's explicitly stated to be mathematics. Is that magic spells change in the universe are actually a slightly obscured truth, the actual real truth of the universe being mathematical formula. And if you could just truly understand mathematics, you would become the most powerful magical wizard in the universe if you could just do that. So that really tickles me in person. And it's interesting because I feel like Gary could have taken one extra step. The one thing that you and I, Paul, have discovered in our games is that we really like having a limit of you can only memorize any spell one single time. And that was not a step that Gary took. It was always permitted in original D&D in first edition that you could memorize multiple copies of one spell and cast, like, you know, 3 cure light wounds or 3 fireballs. And I feel like if he'd taken that extra step and prevented that, he really would have emphasized the Vancian thematics. And I think that people might have less of a problem with it, maybe. And again, as far as a game design, we find that it adds more variety to have different types of spells happen in a particular session. And it kind of resembles a TV show or a movie scene where you don't have like some special move happen again and again and again and again. You're going to see something different through the scenes all the time. So we really like enforcing just one single copy in your brain at any particular time. And I think it emphasizes the Vancian thematics too.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's very Vancian, right? That you have one copy of any given spell. Yeah, for sure. But I think that kind of goes hand in hand with having a well-curated list of spells, right? So let's look really quickly. Here's the list of OD&D. Why does that keep changing on me? Something I have done wrong. Sorry, everyone. Okay. There we go. We have oh my God, you're killing me.
What's happening is partly my fault because I didn't send Paul the images that we wouldn't wanted to look at until about 5 minutes before the show. So this is almost entirely my fault. What's happening?
I don't know why it won't stay. I'm sorry. Well, we're gonna skip it. We're just gonna skip it because
okay.
In the book, in the OD&D book, right? There's a very limited list of spells, right? The first level spells. There's a dozen first level spells, maybe.
Less than that.
Not having it in front of my face.
Right. There is only eight. There's eight first level spells in original D&D.
Right. And for magic users, most you're getting up to
14.
I'm gonna try this one more time and hope that it sticks.
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully. Okay.
Oh, good. That's handy.
For the moment.
Right.
Okay. So, Yeah. So eight spells. And now you published your own variant of the spells, the original edition book of spells, which you can find on Lulu.
Thank you for mentioning that. Yes.
Yeah, of course. I mean, honestly, what I like about this is it's highly curated, right? You've put a lot of thought into every spell and made sure that the lists of spells per level are there, that the words, right, every block of text for every given spell is like a couple of sentences, so it keeps it nice and light and snappy. And I know a recent thing you did was go through and massage all the durations. Spell durations as a BX guy have always been a real thorn in my side. Because of the whole how long is a turn question.
Right.
In BX, if you go by the default of a turn is 10 minutes, you've got lots of spells that are lasting for many hours, which seems odd.
Yeah. And I feel like that's sort of a semi-mistake, is that you had some of these spells come originally out of Chainmail Fantasy, and the first edition of Chainmail Fantasy itself had a grand total of just eight spells total. And so you began this evolution of like, hey, here's a great component of the game to add more to and add more to. You can always add more spells, but it becomes burdensome at some point. And along the way, I think there's this semi-accident of Chainmail had turns that were 1 minute. Okay, and then you had the spell durations in Chainmail, and maybe they were like three or four turns or something like that. And then you get to D&D, and all of a sudden there's this transition of, where we used to say turns were 1 minute, now they're 10 minutes. And I feel like they accidentally multiplied all the spell durations by times 10. And when you get the first edition, you see some of them get dialed back down. They change the durations from turns back to rounds in first edition. But with BX or original D&D, you're kind of in this awkward point of, I think there's this semi-accidental things are lasting for hours situation.
It's honestly, in some cases, I liked it. In some cases, I thought it was actually pretty clever. So that's one of the things I wanted to point out of one of the reasons I like the Book of Spells so much is there are cases where you've given spells durations of a week or a year, right? And I think that's
very
clever. And I think it generally goes up based on level, right? Most of your first level spells are a couple minutes at most, and then you start to get longer. Just giving invisibility a duration of a week is just great. Like, that's long enough to be truly useful, but it doesn't last forever, and so we don't have to worry about a world populated with invisible people, invisible objects all the time.
Exactly, because in the original text, it's permanent. It's actually permanent until somebody attacks something. And so the theory that I came up with is I didn't like, as you're saying, I didn't like first and second level stuff being possibly permanent, like invisibility or charm person potentially, or stuff or continual light or something like that, because it does seem like the world's going to get populated with invisible charmed invisible charm, whatever the third thing I just mentioned was, continual lighted magic items everywhere, because why not? Because wizards are crazy, and someone's probably going to start going around and just doing that troll everybody. And so the theory I came up with actually was to have a, I'm a systems guy, and I apologize if this is too much for anybody, but I came up with, I'm happy for first level spells to maybe last up to a day, and second level, maybe a week, and third level, a month, and fourth level, a year. And then at fifth level, I'm willing to have stuff be possibly permanent. So basically I capped any duration with that theory in mind.
All right, so let me go back here. The reason I brought all this up, besides just to say, well done, Dan, on a book, and when I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When do we get the cleric version? When do we get the cleric book?
I think somebody else. Actually, I will hand off to anybody else that wants it. Someone actually came up with a list like that, and I put it on my blog maybe a year ago. I'd have to go dig up who had done that, but I'm certainly grateful if anybody, if you're the type of person that wants clerics in your game, I forgive you, because I'm not that kind of generous spirit, but feel free to look on my blog for the contribution that someone made for cleric book of spells.
So going back to that, like having casters to cast only one copy of any given spell works well, I think, because it one of the things it does is brings out spells you don't often see, right? And that itself encourages creativity, right? Players are like, well, this is the spell I've got left, how am I going to use it, right? So I love that,
right?
But I think it does have to go hand in hand with a well-curated list. And one of the problems we've seen with wizards over the years is people love to invent spells, and I can't blame them, right? People love to invent spells. Often there's even rules in the game. Let's see, we had a comment earlier that I kind of glossed over in the chat here, asking, you know, what's your take on different ways that wizards can learn spells over different editions, researching and blah, 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 right? So we certainly have rules, right, for across different editions for how do we even invent spells, right? Like maybe it's okay for your players to invent spells, because that was certainly part of Gary's game, right? His players invented spells, and a lot of the classic spells come from that happening, right? I mean, just a week ago, we're talking to Ernie Gygax, and Tensor's got a whole bunch of spells to his name, right?
Right, right. And he was talking Cone of Cold, right? And it's interesting, because it's kind of clever, because original D&D, you only have, your only attack spells originally are just Fireball, Lightning Bolt, that's it. That's actually it. Right. So a lot of the monsters say, you know, they take damage from weapons. They don't take damage from fireballs. They take half damage from lightning bolts, something like that. So it's a little bit of a dodge. But if you come into the game and go, now I'm using cold, haha, none of the monster text says anything about that. I guess I affect everything with cold, haha. But that's among the motivations that get you to make new spells.
Yep. Yeah. So. I have that problem. I see that, like, when I first started on 5th edition, my first character was a wizard, as I mentioned, and we were using D&D Beyond, which unfortunately, due to a glitch, I don't know if this is still a problem or not with D&D Beyond, which would be nice if it was fixed, where even though I had limited myself to just Player's Handbook when creating my character, when I went to populating my spellbook, all the spells are there. All the spells of every source that my DM had, which was like all of them. And I didn't know where spells came from. So I'm like adding spells and going, oh, wait, it came from what text? I don't know.
Right.
Right. And the problem with that is just that there's just so many. Right. And a lot of the authors of books aren't really considering the entire population of the world. Right. It's the DM's job. Yes. You have to decide, what am I letting in? What am I not letting in?
Right.
Which means you gotta read all the damn spells, right?
Right.
So
it's a place where it's a place on that, it's clearly one of the three obvious triad areas that's ripe for expansion in D&D. Is there's spells and there's magic items and there's monsters that are obviously kind of begged for expanded content. Now I would point out that thematically, magic, you know, wizards are kind of key to maybe all three of those. Because wizards are making the new spells, they're making the new magic items, and maybe they're making new monsters like owlbears and peritons and stuff like that, maybe. There's this tension, there's this classic tension between the commerce and the art of, we can definitely sell people more spells, but then the game itself becomes more burdensome, as you discovered.
So my initial gut reaction there, my knee-jerk reaction, which I'm going to now immediately dissolve, is, magic items and monsters, the DM has total control over how those come up because they put them in the world, and then magic items, I don't have to worry about magic items and where they came from because I put down what I want, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of true for spells until later editions, right? So if in early old school D&D, the only way your wizard is going to get new spells is if they find a scroll or a spell book that you as DM put into the world for them to find.
Right. I mean, I will point out, it's a little ambiguous, honestly. The original rules, this is one of those cases where the original rules are really unclear. And Gary had to clarify it later on for both wizards and clerics. Some people read original D&D that clerics also have spell books. It's very ambiguous. And there was just conversation on Twitter just yesterday that I was part of like, how do you do that? And that, you know, spawned a whole bunch of different theories. Certainly the way that you and I play it, Paul, is you have to go find a scroll, you have to go find a spell book and add it. And that becomes a major part. And I like that because it feeds into why are you adventuring? Because that's the only way you're going to get new spells.
Yep. So, so that's really interesting. I think that now the problem I've had as DM is that I don't always think, I don't always have complete visibility on all my players and what their power level is and what spells they have in their books and whatnot.
Yeah.
And what their ambitions are, right? So I've definitely made that mistake of not knowing how frequently to give out the scrolls to give the players that sense of advancement and sense of ownership over their wizard without letting them blow out the power level. And to be clear here, what I was getting at before is that certainly by the time you get to 5th edition, you just get new spells, right? You go up in level, you get some number of new spells, which makes it much easier for the DM, but also opens the door for any spell from random sources to start leaking into your campaign without you having this nice curated list.
Great point.
So what I ended up doing, honestly, in my campaigns is eventually I came up with how can players just buy scrolls? And I put a lot of thought into it. And I started with sort of the direction of, well, let me think, what's the inverse? What would I be okay with a player doing? If a player was like, I'm going to play a magic user and I'm going to scribe scrolls and here's how much it's going to cost and here's my markup and I'm going to sell them. You know, what's the economics for that? And I came up with some rate and I decided, you know what? I'm gonna allow it. I'm gonna have powerful magic users in my world who have apprentices, who part of their apprenticeship is to scribe scrolls that they can then sell for profit.
Right.
And I'm therefore going to limit it to third level and lower, and price it out as to what here's the prices for a first, second, and third level spell. And third level spell is very expensive. First level, I think I priced them at, I want to say 10 gold. Like 10 gold, 20 gold, 50 gold, something like that. Something around there.
Okay.
Which again, in our... you and I have both depressed our economies, so people playing by the book should add another zero on there.
Yes, which would be 100. Agreed. I see what you're saying.
It was really nice, honestly, because that's a way to sort of have the conversation with players of what spells do you want and say, okay, you can have these and not have these, and add a little systemization to it and add a little fiction in world to it so that everyone feels good about it and it not just being like, can I please have more powers?
Gotcha.
Yes,
gotcha.
No, here you go, right? Like,
And you as DM, you're carefully controlling what's available on those, so it's not purely just I ask for anything in the book and the answer is always yes. You're carefully controlling what's available.
Interestingly, what I ended up doing eventually was adding dice rolls to it. So I made tables.
Okay.
So I would say, this is how many scrolls, this... And it was location-based, right? Okay, know this powerful wizard lives in this town. He has these three apprentices.
Right.
Here's how many per week he's going to generate, and I'm just going to random roll on some tables. Another nice reason to have a very tight list of spells is very easy to roll dice on.
Right? Yep.
8, 12, or 20 spells are... kind of perfect.
Totally. You know, it's funny because so obviously the books, BX and first edition tend to talk about scrolls as maybe talk about that primarily as a way to get new spells. I started emphasizing the spell books more. So in my game, you know, I was trying to go rather carefully, and this, again, this is the original D&D Little Brown Books that Paul bound for me, which is the best thing ever. So I'm just kind of looking at some stuff right now. So I was trying to run the game with the by the book treasure rules, and it turns out I was being way too stingy with magic items in general and scrolls in particular. So how many scrolls popped up from the random generation method? None, frankly, none. So that was clearly way too stingy for the player character wizard advancement. And I committed, I realized that I had to commit to increasing that, and I committed to paying more attention to spell books. So on the one hand, it's clearly not any part of the rules, but where are the NPC wizard spell books? It never says they've got to be around somewhere, but I committed to, well, they have to be someplace. Maybe they're in a secret panel or trapped in a chest or something. So any NPC wizard somewhere, their spell book is a place where you can find. And then for like NPCs in town, you can get in contact with them, and you would have to interface. They would have to open their spell book for you and share them directly out of their book. I wasn't using scrolls, but maybe it ultimately winds up being sort of a similar thing.
I thought you were going to go a different direction with that, because I feel like there's another unspoken problem with wizards that gets glossed over in a lot of games, which is the physicality of the spell book. How many pages does your spell take? How big and bulky of an item is it? How much protection does it need from the elements, et cetera, et cetera? Right. I feel like that's a thing generally. We all like the visual of, you know, wizards toting around these books and paging through them and whatnot. But then, like, the moment we got to swim across a river, it becomes a royal pain in the ass.
Good point. I had a post maybe about 6 months ago where I did a little bit of research into like medieval tomes, and then I actually mocked up a book of the correct size. So I guess, like, again, in Unearthed Arcana in first edition, Gary specified the size of a official spell book, and if you look, it's huge. It's like Amazon packaged, like 6 inches deep size. And I got an Amazon package like that, filled it with paper, right? It's like about 5 math textbook size, and it weighs approximately 20 pounds or something like that.
Yeah.
And I have a picture on my Twitter feed or something like that of me hauling it around. So that's actually, I'll say that's what I did. So I actually did add to my equipment list a spell book that weighs a whole stone, which is 14 pounds. And I do actually require my player character wizards to add that to the character sheet. And it kind of works because they're not carrying anything else anyway. So it's kind of funny that they're carrying around a one stone giant book. And I actually do require them to keep track of that.
Are you tracking how many pages it has and how many pages a spell takes?
I don't do that.
Yeah, because that's an interesting detail that unfortunately, you know, undermines itself, because then now I've got multiple books that I'm carrying around. I certainly had one player. Yeah. Who, like you, I did the thing where I said, every NPC spellcaster must have a book, and where is it? And then by the end of the campaign, he's carrying around like 3 or 4 books because he's recovered them, and he's kept them from enemy spellcasters, right?
Right.
And so now he's carrying around like 3 or 4 of these things. And like that.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, spellbooks, I think, become a lot like pets in D&D, right?
Yeah.
The problem with pets is that they're fun when they're fun, and then you forget about them, and then somebody remembers them at the least convenient moment, and you're like, oh, but where is my spell book if we're going to go, you know, for a swim? And like, oh, for crying out loud.
I think the comic strip Order of the Stick, right, started off fairly early with that gag, right, of like, where's my familiar? And then here I am. Yeah, right. Yeah. And interestingly, then later on he committed to like making that familiar a more regular part of the cast, but that's you're right. Yeah. And the other thing that you're reminding me, so volume one here it's literally the very last page. It is the last paragraph of the last page of the first ever D&D book, and it says characters who employ spells are assumed to acquire books containing the spells. Notice that it doesn't say, you know, wizards versus clerics. It just says any character who employs spells assume to acquire books containing the spells they can use, one book for each level. And I don't think they ever said that again.
Interesting.
But there is an argument for every separate level of spell, you have to have a separate book up to like 6 or 9 or whatever you're doing. I don't do that. That seems excessive to me, like you're saying. But you know, maybe that's an interesting detail if you were committing to doing that. Not a step I've taken personally.
Yeah.
Good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Let me talk more about books, because this actually was my main thesis that I wanted to get across here when talking about wizards. Is I am a person of the book, right? Is supposedly one of the first things that I ever said to my parents that they remember as a kid, and I might have been five, which is oddly right around the time D&D was published for the first time, is I said, hey, you can learn anything in the world if you just read the right book. I said, all information, the entire world is available if you just read the right book. And that was the first light bulb that ever went off for me as a little kid. And that, right, that, and I think, Paul, you know, that's, I'm pretty consistent on that theme of like, wow, written books are the most amazing technology that anybody ever came up with ultimately. And, you know, it's funny because we're kind of at this historical moment whereby, you know, maybe physical books are all of a sudden becoming kind of passe based on other technologies, but they have been the primary way of distributing knowledge in our culture for at least 2,000 or 3,000 years. And certainly when I was growing up, that was the only way. And I, you know, so wizards digging through libraries that have tens of thousands of volumes on a quest for hidden lost knowledge. I mean, that's how I went through school, and I spent, you know, all my high school in a college library doing that thing. And you and I, Paul, are in the, as far as learning the game goes, are in this very small niche group where we learned D&D, we learned the game from a book, not a human being mentor. And we've both been basically DMs from day one of the knowledge, and the thing essentially being in a book has been basically where all my knowledge has come from. The thing that my teaching tries to emphasize, how we learned the game. And so the fact that the in-game wizards are perusing studiously in books, and simultaneously that's echoed at the table with the wizard players leafing through a book, trying to find the right spell and trying to make sure that they know the mechanic right, just thrills me to death that, you know, and I don't want to go full cosplay or something like that. But the fact that that's echoed with the wizard players actually going through a book, like the wizards themselves are studying their spells, is one of the most delightful things about D&D for me. And so the emphasis of the book, the game itself is in a book, and the best magical powers are in a book, and the players are in a book. I mean, that's why I made Book of Spells, is I wanted every wizard player to have their own copy and not be passing it around. And that itself is actually just physically one of the reasons why I actually did make Book of Spells. Now, a lot of people prefer Paul's deck of spells. And once again, I'm going to honor that. And if you've made lots and lots of players happy with your official deck of spells version, which is available on GameCrafters, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. I like the book. Players, like cards, and that is perfectly fine. But when players are leafing through a book, boy, that just everything's on all cylinders for me at that point.
I totally agree with you, honestly. I mean, I love that nature of, like, because it's a small PDF and in booklet format, it's easy to print out these things and hand them out and have everybody have one. And I think it's very clever to have that kind of... I like stuff, honestly, where a physical prop ties into the actual mechanics of the game. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I do want to go total cosplay with it. I do want to make, like, a big, crazy, like, weathered-looking tome that maybe has one of these spells per page, because that's, you would have to write them that big to fill up such a book. But I would love, I think that would be actually really
funny. Expand on this thought, and I'm going to be right back.
Yeah, so I think that'd be very funny, for a player to be flipping through these things. To which end, now Dan's going to miss this brilliant thought, but to which end, perhaps one could take that in with the, there you go. See, but it's not far enough, Dan. I want it to look like leather bound and crunchy clasps and weather crinkled pages and scrawly, spidery scripts. And I want the whole freaking prop.
You're right.
I got to think about props, as you may have noticed on my back wall there, of a variety of props from past games
I had one day to make this for, it actually wasn't even Halloween. It was a good friend of ours was having a costume party, a birthday in like November, December. So I had one day to do this plus sew my robe. So this is the nice. Best. This is nice. The best you've got.
Well, it's very good. Saturday it's very good. I mean, yeah. It's a very clever physical prop.
I'll say the other thing is that I actually had. It has a pocket in the back, so I was actually carrying around copies of the Book of Spells pamphlet of for me to hang that hand out as prizes while I was doing that. Yeah,
that's great.
But you're right. No, leather bound, even bigger than that. You're totally correct. I would queue up for that.
Yeah, I totally want that. On the other hand, also maybe if I had more art skill to draw this kind of thing, now I want a deck of spells that look like fancy ornate tarot cards with maybe the actual description of the spell scrawled. So now I'm going to play my spellcaster as like reading the cards, and I don't know. Now I'm getting really excited about this ridiculousness.
You're right. Please vote in the comments. Which is more important to you? Big leather bound booky tome, classic tome, or fancy tarot card deck? And that might be a new future product.
The nice thing about the cards, I think, that a lot of people like is the ability to get subsets of spells and organize, right? You can have a deck that is your spell book. These are all the books and spells I know. You can draw from that. Here are my memorized spells. Now I have a handful of memorized spells. And when you're doing one for one, you can cast the spells and you do so by playing the card. And if I cast a strength spell on Dan, I just hand him the card that says, here's the strength spell, Dan. You now have the spell.
It's super handy. Yeah, particularly when you're handing off those effects, as we said, to non-Wizards players. So
yeah,
you're supporting the fighters, you're supporting the thieves. Well, those are players that have not studied the book. They haven't memorized it. They don't have a book. So the fact that you can say, here is the effect, and just hand it to you on a short card, that actually is a huge benefit at the table, actually.
Yeah.
You're totally right.
I like totally cards. I got a thing for cards. Yeah. 5th edition spell cards broke my heart by making them different sizes. Why would you do that to me?
That's lunacy. That's crazy lunacy. I mean, somewhere in the world, someone knows why, right? Like, I'm sure that they are not going to want to publicly state, but again, that information, to see, that's information that exists in the world that is not in a book currently.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would really like to know why that mind-boggling choice was made of having two different sizes of cards in the same deck. That seems crazy.
So let me go back to, because we have like 10 minutes left here. You're right. Wizards are just a very big topic. There's a lot of things about wizards. We talked about a little bit about how you gain spells and what the differences are across editions and et cetera. One of the big things I think that is really interesting for us is the who plays the wizard question, right? And is it a chore or is it an honor? I feel like I see that come up time and time again, right? That there's an expectation that's been built in us from D&D from the early 70s. Whether or not 5th edition adheres to this or not, I can't really, maybe not as much as it used to be, but that there's this complexity arc through the classes, right?
Yeah.
That I feel like when we run OD&D at conventions, we often see people come to the table who are vaguely familiar. They're like, yeah, I played once, or I used to play a bunch, but I don't know the intricacies of old school D&D, so I'm going to have to, you know, relearn a little bit here on the fly at the table. And then they're hesitant to play a magic user because they're like, oh, that's a lot of complexity. That's a lot of things that I need to deal with. Yeah. A lot of decision making. On the other hand, like, I think a lot the thing that draws so many people to it is exactly that complexity, right? People who are like, yes, I want options. I want to have a million things. I noticed this in our one-on-one game where I was playing a thief. I was like, very cool. I'm playing a high-level thief all on his own. And he's, you know, exploring this, you know, trying to break into this evil wizard's tower. And he had some magic items. He even had a ring of spell storing. So he had a few spells on him. And I was surprised to see that, like, wow, without that ring, there's not a lot to the thief, right? I've got a couple of tricks. And other than that, it's what can I make of the environment around me? Because really, when it comes down to it, I can sneak, I can hide, and I can backstab, and I can climb.
Yeah.
How do I get past this cavern full of ogres with those skills? Well, I guess I'm going to sneak.
Right. Right, you're right. Yeah, a lot of the fighter thief expansions were like, what magic items do you get? And you know, we talked 2 weeks ago about how a major component of fighters is that they get access to the intelligent, spectacular magic swords, and no one else does in original D&D. And it's interesting because you and I mean, we're working at the moment on making some fifth edition characters for an upcoming project, and we were really surprised to see that the DM's guide in fifth edition says that even mid-level characters have zero magic items or maybe one magic item, whereas we're accustomed to maybe at least three or four or five to kind of round out any type of character. Because wizards being the only character that actually has a built-in way of doing spectacular, fantastic stuff. It's a good point. Wow. And I will say that, you know, the point about we keep coming back to the graduated complexity, and I'm always reminded of that Richard Garfield comment, is that games evolve over time to cater to the expert players. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I'm really happy that, you know, original D&D had this built-in graduation whereby maybe that didn't have to happen. You have simple stuff with fighters and slightly more complicated stuff with thieves, and the wizards are built to be the expert player field of play. Now, obviously, historically, that turned out not to actually be the case, because I think that things have evolved so that there's a lot more options even for fighters in 5th edition. And I think I'm finding that, like, really brand new players, they don't see that, right? They come to the table and they assume that any class is equally complex, and they don't have any they don't have any fear of just stepping in and taking a wizard maybe as the very first thing. Whereas slightly older school players know about that and have a little more trepidation.
David Heron in the comments here is commenting about how even in 5th edition wizards are still more complex, right? And here's a quick comment from him. Every morning a 5th level fighter wakes up with the same tools, and those tools are basically for killing monsters, right? Which I think is apt, right? Yes.
Right.
5th edition fighters are more complex than 1st edition fighters, and 5th edition fighters have a lot more stuff that they can play with, for sure.
Right.
But still narrowly focused, right? That's the interesting thing for me about wizards, right? The wizard spell list is just so out there that the types of spells, yes, there are combat spells, but there are a lot of spells that are just like, I don't know, they feel more like they were invented of, if I could do anything, what would I want to be able to do? Yeah. Right? And so you have all these crazy spells. I don't know, that's, for me, often when I'm making wizard character, I'm usually avoiding, like, yeah, I at some point I want to throw a fireball, but I'm much more excited about the weird utility spells and how maybe might this come up someday, and how am I going to use this to our advantage? Because you want that rush of that moment of, aha, I've come up with some crazy solution to the problem at hand. Here it is.
You know, another thing that we could have like a whole half hour discussion about is the evolution, right? The evolution of the spells, because originally you didn't have a lot of blasty stuff. You had fireball and lightning. Well, okay, that was in chainmail. You're stuck with that. But like the first level of spells didn't have any direct damage stuff at all. Your offensive spells were either charm, take over someone's mind, or sleep, put them to sleep. No blasty spells. In the first supplement, so I think that some people have said the biggest single surprise when they open up original D&D is there's no magic missile. Didn't exist to begin with. And that was invented in the first supplement a year later. In comes magic missile, in comes shield, in comes strength. And then that kind of opens the door to the expectation that there's going to be direct blasty stuff at every level. And that kind of changes the tone of the wizard from, you know, kind of ambiguous, possibly charlatan, you know, someone fell asleep. Well, maybe they're just narcoleptic. Maybe he doesn't have any magic powers at all. It's maybe a little bit ambiguous, but when you hit somebody with a magic missile, obviously that you're confirming that there's magical forces in the world that are clearly evident to everybody.
See, I really liked, and this is a thing you and I have debated about, but I like that, like, for example, at second level, most of the spells, heck, all of the spells are non-combat, right? That they are, you know, you get your magic missile at first level and you get your fireball at third, but in between is this battery of weird utility spells that, you know, a third or fourth level wizard is walking around and still using magic missile as their primary, like, do some damage spell because all their second level spots are taken up by weird shit like, I don't know, web or levitate or, you know, whatever.
There are days, I mean, when I wrote Book of Spells, right, like, one of the biggest challenges, because I am not fond of how they expanded the spells in the first supplement, right? They expanded the levels to include 7, 8, or 9, which I have a whole thesis about. And even to this day, I'm like, should Magic Missile be there in the first place? And I'm like, some days that makes me uncomfortable, but people step in D&D, they expect to see Magic Missile. So I feel like I had to make that available. So you're saying we had a debate. Was I arguing against?
The debate is really about the spell pyrotechnics.
Right? Yeah, that's what I thought it was going to be. I was like, basically, this is the pyrotechnics debate. It's not level debate. It's the pyrotechnics debate.
Well, but right. I thought I remember you saying that you wanted a spell at second level that was a, you know, combat-y, a half step between Magic Missile and Fireball.
That was part of my defense of pyrotechnics, yeah.
Get rid of it.
That might not be a first order philosophical principle that I'm going to die on. But I'll tell you, boy, my players, they never actually got pyrotechnics in their spell book. But man, even we're playing other games. We're actually playing other games. Friday night, we were playing Troika. And one of our better players was looking at the power list going, I think this is like pyrotechnics. Everybody close your eyes, she said. Everybody close your eyes because I'm using this. Right? We knew what was happening. It was the pyrotechnics analog that was happening right there.
Oh, jeez. All right, we're about out of time here, Dan. What any final thoughts on wizards?
So I gotta say, right? So you start talking wizards, and all of a sudden you're unlocking, as you said at the beginning. I can't believe the time's gone so fast. You're unlocking all the interesting, fantastical, magical powers, things that make D&D not just the real world, not papers and paychecks. And so, you know, you start talking wizards, and now you're talking spells, and we've made our own products to try to tune and curate the spells the way that we've wanted to, you know, with kind of tasteful edits. And we have also had a mutual series on our blogs called Spells Through the Ages for a number of years that I continually think about, you know, building out more. So, you know, feel free to check out Paul's blog or my blog and search for Spells Through the Ages, and you'll actually see a joint series that we were writing as much as maybe 10 years ago, possibly. And we're considering rolling out like a short video series actually to continue the Spells Through the Ages. So kind of on the back burner, if you think that would be a good idea, leave a comment about that. And we may be doing that in video form in the future. So I have a great appetite to talk with people more about what the spells ought to look like.
Yeah. I think that's the key for me is, that as much as I hate to say it, that DMs really, it behooves you as DM to make sure you have a handle on all the spells in your game. And that feels arduous at higher levels, later editions of the game or when there are lots of supplements and whatnot. But yeah. I think that you'll appreciate it, your players will appreciate it, if you go through and make sure you're saying this is allowed, this is not allowed, this is just to work with my world. It's a lot of work. Honestly, like I am begging Dan to make the cleric version of this book because I'm too freaking lazy to make it myself. But at some point I think I just need to do that, need to go through. Cause I do, imagine someday playing games that have brought clerics back. I don't know. The thing is, it'll never be done, right? We will continue to, continue to debate and tinker with our rules and continue to modify stuff. But this is a great resource. Book of Spells, definitely recommend. Check it out if you're running any of the old school D&D editions. Definitely worth it. So I feel like we've touched on a million things, that there are a million subtopics here. Maybe we need to have like a whole show just on spell books or a whole show just on how to, you know, spell progression. Like there's so much. So
You're right.
So yeah.
Or a whole series on individual spells. A whole series on individual spells, perhaps.
Yeah. If you have thoughts on spells or magic users or wizards, stuff that we didn't get to touch on, or any thoughts that you would love to see us expand more? If you think that, yeah, you want to see a whole hour on spellbooks or similar, let us know. Drop a comment here in the video, and we will be very interested, I think, to see what folks want to hear about.
I would totally like to see that. Now, Paul, did you know that it is actually possible to interact with the Wandering Dams by doing such actions as liking and following and subscribing on a multitude of sites, including YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and also Facebook, where we appear under the handle Wandering DMs on each of those sites? Did you know that?
Yep. I did know that. And if you want to play a game run by the Wandering DMs, you should check out Con of Champions next weekend. That's the Memorial Day weekend. Dan and I are running two games. I believe we currently have a game Sunday afternoon that is got still ample tickets available. So get on there. I think it's basically free, or like cost $2 or something to get a badge. Get on there, come play a game online with us.
Which will be just an hour after our show that week. So actually you can watch our show, and we'll turn around. We'll be running that game at Con of Champions just an hour later next Sunday, as a matter of fact.
That's right. Yeah. We will be having special guest next week, Keith Amon. Who author of the book The Monsters Know What They're Doing, which is a great book.
Primarily for 5th edition, but also a lot of material there. I love that idea of a book that's focused, like his blog is, it's focused on different strategies, like really well thought out analysis of strategies for every single different type of monster. And man, when I first saw that, I was jealous. I was really jealous. It was like, that was an idea I should have maybe had, but he's the one that had the idea and also executed on it. And obviously, the idea is 5% of your product, and the execution is 95%. So Keith Amon has definitely executed on The Monsters Know What They're Doing. Super good work he's done.
Yeah, so join us next week if you want to hear more about that.
Definitely.
Our show is also available in audio-only podcast format. If you would like to listen to us instead of watching us, you can do so by visiting our website, wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcast on a variety of podcast carriers, such as iTunes and Google Podcast and Spotify and etc. If you are listening to this show on one of those sites, please just take a moment of your time to rate and review our show. We really appreciate that.
We definitely do. Thanks to the patrons who support our show, without whose help we could not do what we're currently doing at the moment at this time. If you would like to join them in supporting our show, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We currently have 4 live shows a week. We have the talk show on Sunday. We have the solo show on Tuesday, where we're going to start running a Call of Cthulhu game with me as the player on Tuesday, actually. Thursday, we have 10 Dead Rats. Saturday night, late Saturday night, 9 p.m., we have Book of War Wargaming, in which I'm currently smarting from getting spanked by Isabel last night. I was destroyed. So look for that. And I'm going to try to take my revenge next Saturday. And then, of course, the talk show is live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us next week for special guest Keith Amon, author, as Paul said, of The Monsters Know What We're Doing. Really excited to have Keith on next week. So please do join us for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.